I'd have to say that I'm always a little surprised to be introduced as a historian, and I tend to look around to see who's going to stand up and approach the microphone. But I think of myself as a translator of ancient poetry. That is, someone who frames and represents language in its most concentrated form, language at its most potent, even language as revelation. To translate for me means that one must first find a way to live inside the ancient words. One must come to feel the meaning of the words, and then one must bring these words into the present, into our contemporary tongue, so that people of the present may say, now I understand these ancient people who seemed so unlike myself. Now I can sympathize with their sorrows, laugh at their jokes, dance their dance. History must be learned in pieces. This is partly because we have only pieces of the past. Shards, ostraca, palimpsests, crumbling codices with missing pages, newsreel clips, snatches of song, faces of idols whose bodies have long since turned to dust, which give us tantalizing glimpses of what has been, but never the whole reality. How could they? We cannot encompass the whole reality, even of the times in which we live. Human beings never know more than in part, as through a glass darkly, and all knowledge comes to us in pieces. That said, it's often easier to encompass the past than the present, for it is past, and its pieces may be set beside one another, examined, contrasted, and compared till one attains an overview. Like fish who do not know they swim in water, we are seldom aware of the atmosphere of the times through which we move, how strange and singular they are. But when we approach another age, its alienness stands out for us, almost as if that were its most obvious quality. And the sense of being on alien ground grows with the antiquity of the age we are considering. I first came in contact with people of another time and place in the sayings, stories, and songs my mother taught me when I was little. These were pieces of an oral tradition passed on to her by her mother, who died before I was born, a countrywoman from the Galway Midlands. So many of the words were strange to someone growing up in 20th century New York City. When you've harrowed as much as I've plowed, then you'll know something. You never know who'll take the coal off your foot when it's burning you. Every old shoe finds an old sock. I had been to a farm once, but I had never seen harrow or plow in use. I knew what coal was, but I had never been warmed at an open coal fire. I surely knew what shoes and socks were, but nothing of the archaic courting practices of the Irish countryside. My mother explained patiently that this last was meant as a hilarious send-up of old maids and their prospects. The sexual aspect of the imagery she doubtless left for me to work out for myself. But the waves of words had a sort of triple and simultaneous effect. First, the experience of coming into contact with alien lives through the medium of the words they had left behind. Then an acknowledgement of the humanity I shared with these strangers from another time and place. And last, the satisfying thrill that concentrated metaphorical language can give the listener, the electric sensation at the back of the neck announcing the arrival of the gods of poetry. It's through such wisps of words and such tantalizingly incomplete images that we touch the past and its peoples. When I attended a Jesuit high school in New York City and was taught to read Latin and ancient Greek, I had my first scholarly taste of the strangeness of other ages. Reading the stories left behind by Ovid, Virgil, Sappho, Homer, I felt I'd been given the key to the souls of dead men and women, people who had lived more than 2,000 years before me, in Homer's case, nearly 3,000 years. The Jesuits were verbal but not visual. Though they pointed us in the direction of words, they failed to mention the sensual delights in which the city abounded, the things to be discovered, for instance, in the great museums and concert halls, to speak only of the most obvious. Just around the corner from my school was the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And there in the old gallery of classical art, I first saw the faint traces of paint on the classical marble statuary and learned that the eyeless bronzes had once been fitted with lifelike irises. There I saw an accurate model of the Parthenon with its excited and boldly colored frieze of gods and heroes. I came to understand that ancient Greece had not been a collection of tasteful white marble statues, but a place on fire with color. I made the connection between these astonishing figures that now lived along Fifth Avenue and the brilliant colors of Homer's metaphors, the wine-dark sea, the rosy-fingered dawn. I had, without yet knowing it, put the literature in a context. Now, the labor of learning the context of a work of ancient literature can be painfully slow, like that of an archaeologist uncovering an ancient site and then with patience and care digging gingerly, dusting carefully, examining, identifying, and finally gaining an overview. It requires logic and intuition, book knowledge, and life experience. You must bring to bear all the weapons in your arsenal, sometimes all your cleverness, at other times all your simplicity. But finally, having set the literature in its context, you must leap into the words and find the human being. Every culture, however strange, however alien, however distant from us, has something in common with us and our experiences. The people of the past saw the world in very different ways. Their religions, philosophies, and worldviews were often so different from ours that they might as well have been creatures from outer space. But the human body has not changed. We weep, laugh, sweat, bleed, just as they did. And because of this, we can find communion with them. We must acknowledge the differences in philosophy. Then we must find the similarities of feeling and make the human connection. When I was writing How the Irish Saved Civilization, or civilization, to say it in the British manner, the introductory volume to the Hinges of History series, I almost despaired when I came to St. Patrick. His first biographer had written of him 200 years after his death and had few documents at his disposal. This biographer was a monk of the Abbey of Armagh, which St. Patrick had founded, and his main point was to prove that Patrick was a greater saint than any other. And he did this by making his subject a wonder worker and magician who frightened all the snakes out of Ireland and went around saying, "Zap, you're dead," to anyone who got in his way, after which the offending party would keel over and die. And I found myself unimpressed. I read the modern biographies of St. Patrick, most of them written by pious souls who saw their subject through such a soft focus of unrelenting goodness that he no longer had any human reality. I decided to remove the saint from Patrick's name. Saint was not his first name, and surely he hadn't grown up with his mother calling him that. He wasn't a saint to himself. No one is. So if I wanted to get close to Patrick, I'd have to see him as he saw himself. His mother didn't even call him Patrick, but Patricius. He was a Roman citizen of the island of Britain, which was then, in the late 4th and early 5th centuries, a Roman province where everyone spoke Latin. Calling St. Patrick Patricius seemed to give him an entirely new identity, something to build on. When I came to Patrick's own autobiography, which were a few pages written toward the end of his life, after he'd spent some 30 years in Ireland speaking Irish and nearly forgetting the Latin he had been born to, I began to approach a real human being. The Latin of Patrick the Old Man is execrable, the worst Latin ever to come down to us. Undoubtedly worse Latin than Patrick's was once written, scribbled notes and laundry lists, but none of these have survived. The great difficulty in reading Patrick's Latin, if you know any Latin at all, is not that your Latin may not be good enough, but that it may not be bad enough to understand him properly. And I spent many weeks reading and rereading Patrick's few pages of autobiography. He would have gotten an F for organization. At one moment, he's telling us about something that happened to him as a young man, and the next moment, he's telling us about something that may have happened only yesterday, but he doesn't bother to alert us to the change in era. He has few connectives and no transitions. But gradually, that's a transition. From these few ancient pages written 1,500 years ago, a real human being began to emerge. He was no wonder worker, no magician, and he claimed no special powers. He shows us first his easy life as a boy in Roman Britain. His parents were loving, resourceful people who owned estates. His father was a municipal official, and his grandfather was a priest. They were members of the local gentry, not the most prominent, but comfortable, sheltered people. Patrick himself was a bit of a brat, a brash, entitled teenager who felt fenced in by his parents' way of life and their aspirations for him. He thought their Christian religion more than a little silly, and the one thing he was certain about was that he was not going to follow in his father's footsteps. But one morning, the unthinkable happened. He was kidnapped by Irish pirates who brought him to Ireland in chains and auctioned him off like a calf. For the next 6 years, from the age of 16 to the age of 22, the period that is the crucible of personality in each human being's life, Patrick was a slave to one of the mad warrior kings of Ireland. These were people who did not care about their own lives, let alone the lives of others. The Irish were then completely outside the Roman Empire and the civilized world. They were not only the great slave traders of their day, they were practitioners of human sacrifice, and they warred with one another constantly. They didn't fuss too much about providing pleasant working conditions for those in their employ. Patrick tells us that he worked outdoors as a shepherd, and that he often went hungry and naked, and this in a rainy country where the temperature seldom rises above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. He was completely alone. He could not even understand the language, and needless to say, his employers, who did a lot of threatening and shouting, did not provide him with a course of language CDs. It was in these woeful circumstances, Patrick tells us, that he began to change. His abduction had already changed his life, but now the inner Patrick began to change. Completely cut off from everything familiar, he began to pray to the God of his parents, whom he had once made such fun of. In order to understand how Patrick kept his sanity, we should probably compare his plight to the situation of a modern American or European hostage in a place like Iran. As so many of these men and women have told us, after their release, the solitude, their inability to communicate with anyone, even their captors, the lack of any intellectual stimulus, almost drove them insane until they discovered prayer, which brought them peace and tranquility and a sense of hope, even in the most desperate circumstances. Patrick did finally escape, but he could never settle down again to the pleasant, quiet life of the British countryside. He was no longer the person he had been when he left. His restlessness kept him traveling. At length, in middle age, he returned to Ireland as a bishop, bringing with him the gospel and the Christianity he had once despised. He became the first person ever to bring this gospel of peace and love to a barbarian nation. He became the first person ever to condemn slavery as immoral. He convinced the Irish to give up the slave trade and to cease their sacrifice of human beings. He even got them to limit the cattle rustling and the ensuing warfare that had been their bread and butter. His strange experiences made him into a different man from the man he would otherwise have become. And he made something of his experiences. That is to say, with the help of the impossible Irish, he gave his strange life a meaning and a purpose. Now, I must tell you about Frank McCourt and the nipples. Before Frank's memoir, Angela's Ashes, was ever published, I met Frank at a party not long after the publication of How the Irish Saved Civilization and found that he was one of my readers. "Where'd you get that stuff about the nipples?" said he. "I never heard that before." Patrick tells us that after he'd escaped from his slave master, he was about to board a ship which he was sure was sitting there in the harbor just for him. But the captain refused to take him. Now, Patrick was an escaped slave, and he looked like one. He could not have expected to remain free many hours, maybe even many minutes more. He needed to get on that ship. He walked away to a little hut to pray, and one of the sailors followed him there to say that the captain had changed his mind. When Patrick returned to the ship, the crew greeted him by inviting him to suck their nipples. Patrick declined politely. And then the sailor said, "Oh, well, come on board anyway. You can make friends with us whatever way you like." Now, Frank had never heard about the nipples because Patrick's alarmed biographers regularly leave them out. Patrick himself fails to explain the significance of the incident because the meaning must have been evident to the readers of his day. There must, therefore, have been a well-known custom among the Celts of nipple sucking for the sake of friendship. By declining to participate, Patrick gives us an idea of how bizarre even he found the Irish and how rude and unrestrained their world must have been. Well, though I learned Hebrew before writing The Gifts of the Jews, the second volume in the Hinges of History series, I was exceedingly happy to find that Everett Fox's translation of the five books of Moses answered many of my needs. One should probably not take on the task of translating Hebrew, biblical Hebrew at least, without a direct call from above, which I had not received. And Fox's translation has all the earthy tension of the original. Biblical Hebrew developed as a desert language, and it exhibits the economy of desert people, the very opposite of Victorian English, which never uses fewer words if it can use more. Hebrew will not use three words if two will do. It will not use two words if one will do. If it can get away with silence instead of words, it will do so. And much of the meaning of the Hebrew Bible is to be found in its silences. This is because in the desert, every movement is dehydrating, and desert people learn to think before they move and think before they speak. They are elegant conservers of energy. When Amos, the great prophet of the northern kingdom, tries to move the people to abandon their trivial pursuit of economic status and to take account of the poor, he says most beautifully, Veyagal kamay mishpat veitzadaka kenakal etan, which I would translate, let your justice flow like water and your compassion like a never-failing stream. The English takes 20 syllables, the Hebrew only 15, and this is Hebrew at its most expansive. In the gifts of the Jews, the figure I found myself most attracted to was not a saint, but a king. David, the shepherd king, who 3,000 years ago united the tribes of Israel into one nation. Here again, my search for the inner man centered on the writings that the man had left behind. We know King David's outer story from the book of Samuel, how he began as a shepherd boy who killed the giant Goliath and was anointed king by the prophet Samuel, how his reign brought greater peace than Israel had ever known, and how he could not keep his pants on or his loincloth up whenever he encountered a beautiful woman. Politics hasn't really changed all that much. And how he arranged the slaughter of one man whose wife he wanted to have, and how in old age his favorite son rose against him. The book of Samuel, in which all these stories are so well told, is a chronicle, an early Israelite history. But David's inner story, the story of his emotions, is told in another book, the book of Psalms. And some of these psalms, which were poems sung to musical accompaniment, were actually written and performed by David himself. David was an intense man, perhaps one of the most intense men who have ever lived, a great sinner and a great poet, which is a terrific literary combination. Unlike Patrick's stumbling Latin, David's Hebrew is a model for all lyric poetry from his own day to ours. David's the first person to use the word I, as we use it, to mean one's interior self. And this is an astonishing accomplishment for the 10th century BC, because a sense of the inner self is notably absent from all other ancient literatures. Prior to the humanist autobiographies of the Renaissance, we can count only a few isolated instances of the use of I to mean the interior self. But David's psalms are full of eyes, the eye of repentance, the eye of anger and vengeance, the eye of self-pity and self-doubt, the eye of despair, the eye of delight, and the eye of ecstasy. The psalms are a treasure trove of personal emotions and a unique early roadmap to the inner spirit, previously mute, of ancient humanity. Whereas the historian must normally guess at the emotions of his subjects from incomplete or indirect evidence, David's Psalms reassure us that 3,000 years ago, people laughed and cried as we do, bled and cursed, danced and leapt, that our whole repertoire of emotions was theirs. But the historian is seldom lucky enough to find a subject like David, who's already let it all hang out in black and white. Sometimes the historian's subject may even be someone he comes to loathe, whose emotions he isn't especially interested in sharing. I found this to be the case with Desire of the Everlasting Hills, the third volume in the Hinges of History series, which begins with the story of Alexander the Great. Like Patrick, Alexander first comes to our attention as a spoiled teenager who's bummed out by news of his father's military victories. "There will be nothing left for me to conquer," pouts Alexander, not yet the great. Whether or not the rumor was true that he murdered his father to get his throne, he was acclaimed king of the Greek state of Macedon at the age of 20 in the year 336 BC, and immediately embarked on a campaign of conquest such as the world had never seen. Though he intended to conquer the whole world, his loyal soldiers, whom he had inherited from his father, finally forced him to stop midway through India. After they had already conquered most of Eastern Europe, part of Africa, and half of Asia. They said they just couldn't go any further. Okay, said Alexander, but we're going back by way of the Gedrosian Desert because no army has ever been able to do that, and I mean to prove that if I can't own the whole world, I am at least invincible. About 3/4 of his army perished in the desert, but Alexander the Invincible made it home. He died a year later in 323, just weeks short of his 33rd birthday. What was the purpose of his conquests? Power, honor, and fame. How did the conquered feel? Nobody asked, but we can imagine. Wherever he went, he established military garrisons, supposedly for the purpose of disseminating the glories of Greek culture. Their real purpose was economic exploitation of the conquered territories. From a moral perspective, I don't see how that's any different from a holdup. But mine was hardly the attitude of ancient historians like Plutarch, who believed that Alexander aptly came by his title, the Great. He was, they believed, the greatest man who had ever lived. In their eyes, public action, that is, by war and conquest, was the most dangerous and, in consequence, the most noble of all human endeavors. If Plato was the measure of all subsequent philosophy and Phidias of all attempts to carve a man in marble, Alexander was the measure of man himself, a man who put whole cities and races of people to the sword, and who did not hesitate to crucify anyone who displeased him. We may think such a value system outmoded or remote, but it was not so long ago that Napoleon enchanted Europe with his quest to be the modern Alexander, and we have had many examples since then as well. It's not hard to understand what made Alexander tick, for there's a bit of Alexander in many of us. But still, I found unsettling this discovery of a supposedly great man, the greatest, whose values I could not share and whose very emotions I needed to push away. Has human nature changed so radically, I wondered, that there was no one in the whole of the ancient world who shared my loathing for this man and his anti-human violence, the disruption and misery and heartache that his actions caused to millions of people? It seemed to me a test of my method of writing history. If I could not find a point of view like mine in all of ancient history and commentary, then how can I be sure that I am interpreting correctly the emotions of people who may have been as unlike me as interstellar aliens? But then, most unexpectedly, I found the very thing I had all but given hope of finding, an ancient chronicle of Alexander and his successors that saw their depredations exactly as I did. To quote, Alexander of Macedon, son of Philip, defeated Darius, king of the Persians and Medes, whom he succeeded as ruler. He undertook many campaigns, gained possession of many fortresses, and put the local kings to death. So he advanced to the ends of the earth, plundering nation after nation. The earth grew silent before him, and his ambitious heart swelled with pride. He assembled very powerful forces and subdued provinces, nations, and princes, and they became his tributaries. Alexander reigned 12 years when he died. Each of his officers established himself in his own region, all assumed crowns after his death, they and their heirs after them for many years, bringing increasing evils on the world. What's especially impressive about this terse, dry-eyed epitome is its sympathy for the world of fellow sufferers, people the writer has never met. The author, though we don't know his name, lived in Palestine toward the end of the Greek occupation, but before the Romans had arrived. That is about 100 BC. His limpidly written chronicle is called the First Book of Maccabees, and you may find it in the deuterocanonical or apocryphal section of your Bible. The growing silence of the earth as nation after nation is plundered and laid low by Alexander. The increasing evils brought on the world by generation after generation of such predatory activity, these are extraordinary images to come upon in ancient records, which seldom waste space on the sufferings of losers. And then it's seldom people at the invigorating center of events, the ones who, like Plutarch, normally write the first drafts of history, who see clearly what has happened, especially the increasing evils wrought by those who blindly pursue their own wealth and power. Rather, it is the dispossessed, the ones who have been relegated to the margins, whose eyes are open, and who know what wounds they bear. We may find history in official biographies and state papers, but we're far more likely to find the real story and the deepest emotion in poems like David's and half-literate remembrances like Patrick's and out-of-the-way chronicles like First Maccabees left behind by those whom the world did not consider important. But even in reading a translation of the Bible, the historian must exercise great care. If Patrick's pious biographers thought it prudent to omit certain scenes, the misplaced reverence of translators can make the people of the Bible sound as they never did in life. There's one, this is my R-rated section, anyone who feels he should leave. There's one passage in the Hebrew Bible that I found I had to translate myself because all translators have found it too shocking to translate accurately. This is the story of the response of Rehoboam, David's knuckle-headed grandson, to the northern nobles. It may be found in 2 Chronicles 10:10 and in the Gifts of the Jews on page 208. As with Patrick and the sailor's nipples, many worthy people have felt it would be better if you didn't know about it. The scene is the accession of Rehoboam, son of Solomon and grandson of David, to the throne of the United Kingdom of Israel and Judah. Rehoboam's family were southerners from Judah, and his father Solomon had treated the northerners, the Israelites, badly. So a deputation of northern nobles approached the new king and said, "Your father laid a cruel yoke on us. If you'll lighten your father's cruel slavery, that heavy yoke which he imposed on us, we are willing to serve you." Of course, their courtly language concealed the threat that if Rehoboam did not treat them well, they would withdraw from the union. The court elders counseled Rehoboam to be kind to these people and give them a fair reply, and they will remain your servants forever. But Rehoboam was young and decided to go with the advice of his buddies, who warned him not to commence his reign with a show of weakness. They even wrote a reply for him, because he wasn't so good with words. They were the Karl Roves of their day. And Rehoboam delivered this reply, and it began thus: "My dick is fatter than my father's thigh. So, my father laid a heavy yoke on you? Mine will be even heavier. My father kept you in line with the lash? I'll whip you with scorpions." These, the actual words of the Holy Bible, are always fudged by translators who cannot bear to have such words spoken aloud in synagogue or church, even though I rush to assure you, my translation was made under rabbinical supervision. Needless to say, the political union of Israel and Judah did not survive Rehoboam's studly display, which, I must say, reminds me of any number of strutting verbal aggressions committed by our late unlamented commander-in-chief, George W. Bush. From his empty threat to Osama bin Laden, wanted dead or alive, to his embarrassing Top Gun imitation as he performed in full costume on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier to celebrate the supposed end of the Second Gulf War. Historical parallels are never exact, but they should always give us pause for reflection. It's known, for instance, that when Donald Rumsfeld took over the Pentagon, one of his first acts was to order a study of how ancient empires maintained their hegemony. Why, I wonder, didn't it occur to him to study how each empire, sooner or later, lost everything it had gained? In such a study, he might have found profound occasion for reflection. For further reflection on this subject, I commend to your attention Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter, the fourth volume in the Hinges of History series, in which troubling parallels are noted between America's posture in the world during the catastrophic administration of Bush II and the tragic mistakes made by substandard Athenian politicians after the death of Athens's great democrats, men such as Solon and Pericles, who cannot but put us in mind of Franklin Roosevelt and Jack Kennedy. But for the moment, I think we must leave the subject of historical parallels and return to the subject of translation. If the misplaced reverence of translators can make the people of the Bible sound as they never did in life, no one brings on attacks of reverence more often than Jesus, who was actually humorous, affectionate, and down to earth, who spoke to his friends and followers in a clear and bracing manner, was often blunt, sometimes vulgar, and always arresting. Never did he employ the dreary, self-righteous, even priggish sound that some of his admirers would wish for him. Despite the popularity of the King James Version, Jesus was not a 17th century Englishman. How weird it is that if we wish to understand the Iliad, the Odyssey, or the Aeneid, we would never think of going to a translation that is four, in actuality, nearly five centuries old. We'd be more likely to want the latest translation, the one that speaks to us in our language. In Mark's gospel, for instance, the most primitive of the four gospels, the first words that Jesus speaks are, "The time has come, the kingdom of God draws near." The next word is almost always translated as "repent" or "convert," which makes Jesus sound like a sidewalk freak with a placard in his hands. But the word Mark uses is metanoiate, which means literally in Greek, "change your minds." For the ancient Greeks, the mind was considerably more than it is for us. It was the core of a person, the center of his being. The word we would use more likely is "heart." So in Desire of the Everlasting Hills, I've translated the Greek as "open your hearts," a far cry from "repent." As I insist in Desire of the Everlasting Hills, before all else that may be said of him, Jesus was a prophet speaking like Amos in the prophetic tradition, urging his people to justice like God's justice, to the idea that compassion for those in need is not just a passing feeling or a convenient political slogan, but an abiding obligation. My object in writing the Hinges of History is not to discover new facts or even to offer new interpretations. I always attempt to base myself on the broad middle consensus of contemporary scholarship, avoiding the sensational and fashionable extremes that pass so quickly into oblivion. I'd like each reader to close these books and be able to say, "Now I know what it would have been like to have been a slave in pagan Ireland, to have felt the passion, exaltation, and remorse of David when he played his lyre and wept hot tears, to have been in the crowd that first heard Jesus, to have been his friend, to have been touched by him. And if you can say these things, if I've helped you to see these people, not just to see them, but as Shakespeare said, to see them feelingly, I'll be well satisfied, and I hope you will be too. The Greek of the New Testament, which is called Koine, or common Greek, is much easier to tackle than the complex Greek of earlier periods. Though ancient languages are notable for their modest vocabularies, the world still being young, and the phenomena to be named far fewer than what we face today, Greek is an exception. The abundance of words in a dictionary of ancient Greek is staggering, not only to the student, but to the expert. The Spartans, the Achaeans, the Athenians, the Boeotians, the Aetolians, the Euboeans, the Thessalonians, the Macedonians, the Lydians, the Ionians, the speakers who hailed from the various Adriatic and Aegean islands, the colonists of Sicily, southern Italy, and the Black Sea. These and many more contributed their finely shaded regional vocabularies to the whole language, which became like a vast orchestra of diverse instruments able to produce modulations of extraordinary refinement. Unlike the Jews, the Greeks could never stop talking. And as is always the case with such people, their favorite subject was themselves. The entire library of ancient Hebrew runs to a compact cabinet of 24 scrolls. The books of the Greek library are close to countless. Not only this, but the Greek proceeds in a naturally discursive style, constantly turning this way and that in elegant riffs and delicate variations, like a spring river running to tributaries, curling into rivulets. Even when you're thinking or speaking another language altogether, Greek can scratch away impishly at the back of your brain. Neither as compressed as Hebrew, coiled and ready to spring, nor as mellifluous and tidy as Latin. It is, by contrast, a spiky language, as full of sharp ups and downs as an economist's graph. No wonder that when Virginia Woolf went mad, she heard the birds singing in ancient Greek. The fourth volume in the Hinges of History series, as I already mentioned, is Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. Given what I've told you about the Greek language, you'll understand that I was exceedingly happy to come upon eight excellent translations, especially of Homer and Plato. Only when I reached the Greek lyric poets did I find myself stuck, unable to find translations that deliver the thrill of the originals. So once again, I was thrown back on my own resources. The mechanisms that drive Greek lyric poetry, highly specified varieties of set rhythms appropriate to different moods and occasions, tonal values now lost to us, associated with long and short syllables, musical modes, are so different from most of the mechanisms available in modern English that every translator must despair of recreating a semblance of the original textures of Greek poetry in English. What's necessary is to live inside the Greek long enough so that one has a chance of making a new English poem that can convey similar sense and feeling by the instruments available to us. The ways in which words may be chosen and combined through stress and rhythm, alliteration and assonance and rhyme. The rhyme is never employed in Greek lyric poetry. It's a useful English tool for binding elements together that in Greek are bound together by other means. Ancient Greece was truly a culture of song. Everyone seemed to sing everywhere. The moon has set, and so have the seven sisters. It is the middle of the night, and I lie alone. And I lie alone. That's Sappho in one of her most quoted fragments. And though I want to give you a few more of her poems, we only have a few, that's the only one I've been able to provide music for. So as I give you the others, you must imagine not me, but a small, elegant cabaret singer dressed in what would look to us to be a graceful sari. She sings with precise enunciation and with sad realism, or with comic sprightliness, depending on her subject. To be unmusical, as sly Sappho informs us in a short poem to a deceased woman who had shown talent neither for performance nor appreciation, was a fate worse than death. You might as well never have lived. When you were living, never did you smell the roses by Olympus, where the muses dwell. Now that you're dead, your faded ghost in hell is unremembered here on earth. You ring no bell. This poem, constructed like a well-aimed body blow, is the work of a woman the Greeks called the Tenth Muse, the greatest poet after Homer, born in the late 7th century on the large Greek island of Lesbos, celebrated for the sweetness of its wine and the tartness of its verse. Unfortunately, much of post-Homeric poetry, called lyric poetry because it was usually sung to a lyre, was lost in the upheavals of subsequent centuries, especially in the depredations and decay that would follow the barbarian incursions into the Greco-Roman world in the 5th century. In Sappho, we've been particularly unlucky, for her work survives only in small clusters of words. Here's another one. I love what is delicate, luminous, brave, what belongs to the sunlight. That's what I crave. In longer, less pithy poems, I didn't bother to try rhyme, and this is one of those. Some say cavalry, others infantry, still others say a navy is black earth's most beautiful thing. But I say it's whatever you may love. An easy thing to understand, for Helen, whose beauty surpassed us all, walked out on him one day, her high-class husband, sailed for Troy, and not to child nor doting parents did she give a thought, led to earth's end by longing. So does my soul fly up, remembering Anactoria, gliding lightly, lightly. Now she's gone. I'd rather study her graceful step and the way light moved across her face than look on Lydian chariots or ranks of bristling hoplites. Hoplites being Greek infantrymen. The poem once had 12 more lines. We can no longer read them in the manuscript fragments that are left to us. All we know is that the poem ended with a word that probably means surprise. But even this fragment, wonderful and unsatisfying as it is, leads me to the lesson that writing these books has taught me over and over. Though official history is the record of the deeds of politicians and generals, the actions that actually sustain civilization are the actions of lovers. People who, like Patrick, come to us without swords and with open hands. Love in the open hand, Edna St. Vincent Millay put it, love in the open hand, no thing but that, ungemmed, unhidden, wishing not to hurt. And go on quickly to the last part, which is about the next book in the series of the Hinges of History series, which is called Mysteries of the Middle Ages. I have a section about the Crusades, and I'll only bring you into the last part, because I think there's only one story in all the horrible stories about the Crusades and their bloodshed that can assuage the traumas on both sides and give us hope for the future. In the early 13th century, Francis of Assisi joined the Fifth Crusade, not as a warrior, but as a healer. There can be no doubt that Francis of Assisi was an extremist, as was his model, Jesus of Nazareth. And Francis is the pivotal figure in Mysteries of the Middle Ages. Symbolic gesture, Francis's natural language, was the profound source he was able to call on throughout his life. He was no good at organization or at long-term strategies, and he knew it. As men and then women began to present themselves as followers, Francis accepted them, befriended them, told them to hear the gospel and to stand beneath the cross, but he gave them little else. Francis expected these brothers and sisters to live like him, as the lesser brothers and sisters, as lay people, rejecting any distinctions of class among themselves and lacking all honors of church or king or commune. Taking the words of Jesus literally, never owning anything, married to their poverty and suffering for God's sake, befriending every outcast, heretic, highwayman, leper that God thrust in their path. They must not remain at home, making themselves virtuous and fat like the established religious orders. They must go forth on the roads to live the gospel of God's love and to preach it to all, farmer, bishop, emperor, pope, yet condemn no one. Judgment was the exclusive province of the all-merciful God. It was none of a Christian's concern. Give to others, and it shall be given to you. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven, was Francis's constant preaching. Another of his simple sayings was, may the Lord give you peace. And that was something that you should say to everyone you meet, no matter who they are. Such an approach in an age when the most visible signs of the Christian religion were wars and atrocities committed by the Red Cross Crusaders was shockingly otherworldly and slyly effective. It silenced sermonizing windbags, and it brought archbishops up short. At one point, Francis decided to sail across the Mediterranean to the Egyptian court of Al-Malik al-Kamil, nephew of the great Saladin, who had defeated the forces of the hapless Third Crusade. Francis was admitted to the august presence of the Sultan himself and spoke to him of Christ, who was, after all, Francis's only subject. The attempt to proselytize a Muslim was cause for on-the-spot decapitation, but Kamil was a wise and moderate man who was deeply impressed by Francis's courage and sincerity and invited him to stay for a week of serious conversation. Francis, in his turn, was deeply impressed by the religious devotion of the Muslims, especially by their fivefold daily call to prayer. And it's quite possible that the thrice daily recitation of the Angelus that became current in medieval Europe after this visit was precipitated by the impression made on Francis by the repeated call to prayer. Just as the quintessential Catholic devotion of the rosary derives from Muslim prayer beads. Francis was not impressed by the Crusaders, nominal Christians whose sacrilegious brutality horrified him. They were entirely too fond of taunting and abusing their prisoners of war, who were often returned to their families minus nose, lips, ears, and or eyes. It is a tragedy of history that Kamil and Francis were unable to talk longer, to coordinate their strengths, and to form an alliance. Had they been able to do so, the clash of civilizations might not even be a phrase in our world. Francis went back to the Crusader camp on the Egyptian shore and desperately tried to convince Cardinal Pellagio, whom the Pope had put in charge of the Crusade, that he should make peace with the Sultan, who, though with far greater force on his side, was all too ready to make peace. But the cardinal had dreams of military glory and would not listen. His eventual failure amid terrible loss of life brought the age of the Crusades to its inglorious end. Donald Spoto, Francis of Assisi's most recent biographer, rightly calls him the first person from the West to travel to another continent with the revolutionary idea of peacemaking. As a result of his inability to convince Cardinal Pellagio, Francis saw himself as a failure. It seems to me that Islamic society and Christian society have been generally bad neighbors now for nearly 14 centuries, often eager to misunderstand each other, often borrowing culturally and intellectually from one another without ever bestowing proper credit. And we stand in desperate need of contemporary figures like al-Malik al-Kamil and Francis of Assisi to create an innovative dialogue. We need peacemakers. We need lovers far more than we need generals and politicians. For peace and love are our ultimate needs, the ultimate needs of all of us. Thank you.